Okay, onward. So we got instrumental and structural power down. Tough concept, though. You'll see when you work with, if you work with that concept, there are times when structural power seems to be only really present by virtue of people understanding that it could be instrumentalized. So it's more like unused instrumental power rather than actual. To be full-blown structural power, it never needs to be used. It's just the background context. And, you know, there's arguments that that's actually not as important as people sometimes think it is. It's more important when it's backing up instrumental power, which then makes it really more like instrumental power. I mean, you know, if you have a lot of instrumental power, you don't have to use it all the time because people know you'll get clobbered. The police have a lot of instrumental power when they can mobilize their SWAT teams and their anti-riot teams to come out and beat the shit out of protesters. Well, protesters know that, so the police don't actually have to use it very often if it's predictable and well-disciplined. But that's strictly instrumental power. One wouldn't want to say that the police have structural power because they have instrumental power that they don't use all the time. It's not an unintended consequence of having that capacity to repress that it prevents people from action. It's an intended consequence. One of the purposes of repressive power is to intimidate people so you don't have to use it. And that's why it sometimes happens that police regimes collapse very suddenly because they were paper tigers. They made people think they had repressive capacity, which kept people from doing things. But once, for kind of accidental reasons, a big protest occurs, the police are shown to just not have it in them to repress them. And then things escalate out of hand. That's a typical context. It's part of the story for the collapse of the Soviet Union, too. You know, they had this massive repressive machinery. They had lived through Stalinism. They had lived through Hungary in 56. They had lived through episodes in which it wasn't a paper tiger. When protests occur, the full weight of repressive authority came smashing down on people. And then muddled along by the 1980s, that repressive power was actually pretty shaky, but people didn't know it initially. And then there was testing of it, and the testing quickly showed that there was way more room to maneuver. And the speed of the change was astounding to people at the time. I mean, Dimitro can recount that from his own lived experience. And I think the way to think about that is that people had beliefs about the instrumental power, the actual capacity of the state to intervene to block change, which turned out to be based on myths that had been real at some point in the past, but had really lost that capacity. Okay. The means and efficacy of instruments of power. So this applies to any kind of power. If we're thinking about practice as transformation, there are means of production. So in the economic case, it's all straightforward. We know what it means to have an agricultural system with tractors rather than just hand hoes. You are able to transform nature with less effort. So the same amount of human activity produces much bigger transformations of nature. When you have tractors than when you don't have tractors. The means of production in the economic sphere have increased human productivity to unbelievable heights because of the ability to use relatively modest amounts of human effort to produce massive transformations of nature. That's what it means for the forces of production to increase. Economic power refers to two dimensions. How productive are your means of production, and how monopolized are they by particular groups of people? How concentrated? So The capitalist class has a huge amount of power by virtue of having concentrated ownership of extremely productive means of production. Well, the same thing can be said about political power or ideological power. You want to both ask, how productive are the means of production for producing and transforming relations, for producing and transforming beliefs? And how concentrated is the control over those means of production? Both issues are relevant to the question of how much power a particular group has. And this then immediately raises the question, well, what are the means of production of in politics? How should we think about the instruments of power? I think the simplest, the prototype, I mean, really anything can be a means of production in politics. You know, so money can be a means of production of politics. Money can be a resource that you use to produce and transform relations. So there's lots of resources that can be used. But the prototypical distinctive means of production of politics are political parties and the state, that is, organizations. Both the state and political parties are special types of organizations. And organizations are the prototypical means of production of politics, used in politics. Organizations are central to political power because of their role in mobilizing collective action and constraining choice. But really, any resource that bears on the capacity to transform relations is pertinent to the problem of understanding political power. Political power is also affected by the efficiency of the means of production, not just to the degree to which they're monopolized. And that raises the question, well, how should we understand the productivity of organizational means of politics? Different political organizations are able to produce different effects. They have variable efficacy. States may be strong or weak, for example. States may be corrupt or efficient. Some states have tremendous capacity to get things done. Other states do not. The incapacity of the state is a crucial question. And one of the big problems in, for example, the development in the literature on economic development is precisely why is it that states in developing countries are often so weak? They have such little capacity to produce and transform relations. Similarly, political parties can be weak or strong. They can be coherent or incoherent. They can have a strong capacity to mobilize members or a weak capacity. This was a very big issue in classical Marxism. Lenin's famous essay, What is to be Done, is all about the necessity of a vanguard party, what he called, or what came to be known as a vanguard party, which is a particular kind of organization which made particular kinds of claims about its unique capacity to wage struggle in the context of a revolutionary project. Now, whether or not the vanguard party was a desirable form of political action because of other aspects of its capacity is, of course, a hotly debated question. That it was an effective instrument of struggle, I think, is unquestionable. That is, the absence of a vanguard party in the context of the Russian Revolution would have probably led to different outcomes. The outcomes depended in part upon that organizational form having developed enough coherence that it was capable of organizing concentrated political action in very short time frames when action was needed. Now, it may have done so with disastrous long-term consequences for the prospects of democracy. That's another issue. Or those prospects may have been destroyed by forces completely unconnected to the nature of the vanguard party. That's another position in these debates. But that it was an effective organizational weapon, as it was called, I think is undoubted. All right. That's political power. Now, we get to domination, the next step in this, these building blocks to give us the full vocabulary we need. I like to think of domination as a way of describing the distribution of power, rather than treating power itself as inherently domination. Again, of course, this is just a case of how we're going to use words. If power itself is going to mean domination, that is, we don't talk about power unless it's power over people. If we're going to use power as the equivalent of domination, then we're going to need another word for what I'm calling power, and which could just be the capacity to act. One could do it that way. And I'm not saying that you should privilege my particular terminological use here. I do think you need to make the distinction. It's important to make this distinction. Power is a way of domination is a way of describing the distribution of power. Domination exists when one within a relation. So domination is a description of something going on in a social relation. Domination exists within a relation when one group or individual or category asymmetrically has power over another group or individual or category. If the power of one group over another was symmetrical, that is, each group had power over the other in a symmetrical sense, then I don't think we'd call it, I wouldn't call it domination. It's just a distribution of power in which all groups have power over others. It's not clear that that's a very useful way of talking about an equal distribution of power, but one might think of it that way. So that's how I'm using domination. There's a very important book by Stephen Lukes called Power, A Radical View. Any of you who do political sociology or related matters, it should be basic reading for, you know, any political sociologist, called Power, A Radical View. He talks about the three faces of power. I would call it the three faces of domination, because he's using power as always implying power over. And in the terminology I'm using, those would be called three faces of domination. This is not a theme. His three faces of domination are not something which I'm going to be playing off of systematically in the rest of this discussion, but this is probably a worthwhile moment for me just to state them for you, and they'll be in the notes online as well for you to look at, because I do think this is a very useful distinction. So the first face of domination is simple behavioral domination, it's sometimes called. A dominates B when A can get B to do something even over the objections of B. I dominate you when I can get you to do something even if you don't want to do it, over your objections. That's the most simple, straightforward meaning of domination. I have power over you when I can get you to do something even if you don't want to do it, over your objections. I don't have power over you if the only way I can get you to do something is to convince you to do it. Right? Then I don't have power over you. That's the first face of power. The second face of power is A dominates B when A can define the range of alternatives open to B, within which B freely chooses what to do. So another way that I can have power over you is if I get to determine the four choices you have, and I'm happy with all four. All four of them serve my interests. And I can rule out the fifth interest, the fifth option, which doesn't. So I can determine what your available options are. This is sometimes called non-decision-making power. It's power to determine what's on the table, rather than power to determine what you choose. That's the second face of power. Sometimes it's called negative power. The first sometimes is called positive power. Positive power is power to actually get you to do a specific thing. Negative power is the power to prevent you from doing things that I don't want. You know, just blocking what and determining the agenda. The third face of power is A dominates B. When A is able to realize its own interests at the expense of B's interest, even if B freely cooperates with A. This is sometimes called systemic power. It's not even being able to determine what the range of options are. It's just being able to determine the way the whole system operates, which means that B will always act in ways that serve my interests. I think the third face of power is less clear than the first two. The first two contrasts are very clear. The second one is less clear in Luke's argument. It corresponds, I think, roughly to what in my own work, which in the chapter in Interrogating Inequality, which you read, I call systemic power.
Yeah. It also seems like it has an element of the exploitation concept.
It does have, the at the expense of, right. Although it doesn't,
it's not the same.
And it's not referring only to cases where it's labor effort that's involved. Right. All right. This leads into this nice distinction that was introduced by Bob Alford and Roger Friedland, which has to do with the system logic of different notions of power and domination, which I think is pretty useful and which does bear on how we will think of conflicts around the state in the subsequent sessions, particularly next Tuesday. We can distinguish three levels of the way systems operate: a systemic, institutional, and situational level. And with respect to each of these levels, we can talk about power. This I've outlined pretty carefully in the chapter, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time distinguishing it. I use a game theory metaphor. You can have struggles over what kind of game you're playing, what the rules of a given game are, or what plays or moves you make within a given set of rules. And these structure different kinds of politics. If you're engaged in political conflict over what game is to be played, this corresponds to revolutionary versus counter-revolutionary politics. If you're engaged in struggles over the rules of a given game, this corresponds to reformist versus reactionary politics. And if you're engaged in struggles within a given fixed set of rules, it's liberal versus conservative politics. I think I talked a little bit about this in an earlier lecture. I don't remember which one. Did I go through the soccer example, the football example? Yeah, how it can morph. And the important thing just to think about, which we'll return to particularly at the very end of the course, is whether incremental changes of the rules of the game can over time produce an entirely different game, or whether the only way to move from one game to another is to stop playing one game and start playing another. So at any given moment in time, in the sports metaphor, in any given moment in time, you have a choice. Are you going to play soccer or are you going to play rugby? You know, these are two different games. Everybody knows they're different games. They feel different. Different kinds of players will be better suited for one or another. You know, the game of soccer gives advantages to particular skills and a disadvantage to others. The game of rugby gives advantages to some of the same skills as soccer. Being quick and agile is important in both sports. But there are some skills in rugby that are completely irrelevant to soccer. And if you get to a more radical contrast of games, basketball and soccer, well, there's very different skill sets needed for those. Or baseball, and almost any other sport. Very different skill sets needed. So the standard way of thinking about how you're going to move from one game to another in sports is you stop playing one and you start playing the other. You know, we don't think of the task of how do we engage in reformist versus reactionary politics over the rules of the game of soccer in order to turn it into rugby. Right, that's not the way we would think of it in sports. But that's, of course, the way we have to think about it in society when we're not using, when we're using this as a metaphor rather than as a literal notion of games. And one view is that the only way to change the game itself is to directly act on the game itself. That is, you have to engage in revolutionary versus counter-revolutionary politics. Another view is you can change the game itself incrementally over time by changing the rules of the game. And the sequence at which you change the rules of the game may be important in that respect. That is, some sequences of how you would change the rules of the game will have the consequence of opening up more profound changes in rules later, and other sequences of changing the rules of the game may close them off. So what came to be known as non-reformist reforms in the debates around these issues was precisely, we have the rules of the game of capitalism, but and capitalism and democracy, but we can change these rules in such a way as to open up political space for more radical changes in the rules later. Well, that's the big strategic debate around that socialists and radicals and revolutionaries have had for the last century and a half. The debate takes different forms in different times and places as to whether, if our goal is systemic power and systemic transformation, whether our target has to be systemic transformation or whether our the target or objective, whether our target and objective can simply be at the institutional level. All progressives, radicals, believe it cannot just be at the situational level. That is, you cannot transform a system just by maneuvering within fixed rules to get the best advantage that you for your constituency. That's not going to change the game. The dilemma that reformists have when they get into power, even if they're serious about reform, is that they also have to engage in situational power. They also have to use the power to give advantages right now within the existing game. So there's a tension between trying to change the rules and using the rules to benefit your constituency, let alone a tension between changing the rules and wanting to change the system. So these are the kinds of complexities that come up, which we'll particularly focus on at the very end of the course and on our weekend retreat when we talk about grand projects of transformation. And all of this then brings us to the state, finally. We've got domination, we've got system levels. Now, we need the state. Domination is not just a problem of interpersonal relations, as in the metaphor of A getting B to act in a particular way. Domination is inscribed in social institutions of various sorts and how they're organized. This institutionalization of domination is what's crucial because that's what makes domination within an entire social system stable. The institutionalization, the creation of rules of the game, that's the institutionalization, in such a way as to create systemic stability. In these terms, one could define the state in the following way. It has three elements. It is the most superordinate, territorially centralized institution of domination in a society. Note that I've defined the state as an institution of domination. It's an institution in which power is distributed unequally. It's territorially centralized. It's the domination of this institution occurs over a territory. And it's the most superordinate of the whatever territorially centralized institutions of domination there are. political power may be unequally distributed in many aspects of life. You can have political power unequally distributed within families, within factories, in communities. Each of these may be sites of domination. To the extent that these specific sites in a territory are themselves dominated by a centralized apparatus, to that extent, that centralized apparatus can be called a state. To that extent. This means that the stateness of a state is a variable. It's not a binary. Now, we don't usually think of it that way, but I think that's what you have to, the way you have to think of it. Yeah.
I was just wondering between what's the difference, or if there is no difference, between the state and the government? Are those interchangeable, or are those different?
Right. So usually the word the government refers to the particular regime that's in power.
Okay.
Sometimes the word the government means the executive of the state. So when we mean all the administrative apparatuses of the state. But the state is all of these institutions integrated in either coherently or incoherently. I mean, states vary in the extent to which these all fit together.
So the government is a part of the state?
I'm hesitant to give an unequivocal answer to the question, because I think the term government gets used in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it gets used in a way that is very close to the state.
Okay.
Sometimes it's used to mean the administrative apparatuses of the state. So do we want to say the legislature is part of the government, or the legislature controls the government?
Okay.
The courts. Are the courts part of the government, or the courts? So in the American discussion, I guess we say there's checks and balances within the government. I don't think the language has a completely consistent meaning.
Because the reason I ask is because a lot of, in the kind of the public conversation, people think that more government control means moving toward a socialist state, and that would be bad for, or some people think that's bad.
Right.
Can a state be transformed to not be an institution of domination, or does it then lose its ability to, or its stateness?
So I think states are always concentrated sites of power. The question is whether they can also be subordinated democratically to the people.
Okay.
But even when they're subordinated democratically to the people, even when that's true, they still have authoritative capacity to impose rules on a territory, and in that sense they dominate.
Okay.
But the domination can itself be subordinated. Yeah.
Do I need to try that state is a part of the political system, and political system in its turn is a part of society?
You can say political system. That the expression political system is a very difficult one to pin down. Do we want to regard the governance structures within a factory part of the political system or part of the economic system? It's just not clear exactly what one means when you say political system. There's a wide variety of ways that sociologists try to talk about domains, subsystems, levels. They're all problematic. They always run into difficulties. You have to have such language. And it's a question of whether that's the way that most clarifies the particular problems you're trying to study. If political system, so one way of doing it, the way that people define political system, in which it makes it not quite right to say the state is part of the political system, is that you begin with the state, define the state, and then you say all aspects of the society in which people are oriented to organizing around the state are what we'll call the political system. So the political system is defined by all the systematic activities and practices of people connected to the state. But it isn't as if the political system exists independently. And then we say, well, what is the state within the political system? It's by virtue of the existence of a state that we can define a political system.
Okay, well, I mean, in terms of agents and organizations, do you see kind of state as kind of among other agents, like political parties, organizations, but kind of the most powerful? Or state includes the government and political parties, so just to disentangle.
No, so I would not consider political parties part of the state. It interacts with the state.
And that's why I would like to produce political system, just to use kind of all the agents, just to my mind.
Right. But it's hard to know what isn't in the political system then, because everything interacts with the state. So, I mean, I have avoided using that language. It's fine to use it, though. The state is an institution of domination. The state itself is not really an actor. Now, as a shorthand, we sometimes say that. We say that the state does X. But the state is a complex network of organizations and institutions that are bound up at this kind of territorial centralization of domination over a territory. And it never acts as a coherent single actor. So that's always a shorthand. This is a little different from most Weberian definitions of the state, because I haven't put violence directly into the definition. The Weberian definition is the state monopolizes the legitimate use of violence over a territory. I've described it as the most superordinate institution of domination. One of the ways in which that domination is secured is through the use of violence. But I don't think that that's the pivot for defining it as a state, is that it monopolizes the legitimate use of violence. It's one of the ways that states establish and enforce its territorial domination. But there's all sorts of other ways that states do this, and violence may not be the most central. So I don't think that privileging violence and putting it at the very definitional core of the state actually clarifies its character. The state enforces rules over territories, but the enforcement can be through all sorts of mechanisms other than violence. It's a little bit at odds with some Marxist definitions of the state, because I haven't built into the very definition of the state the issue of class domination. I've just described the state as the most superordinate institution of domination, not the most superordinate institution that secures and reproduces class domination. Now, one of the problems that states face as the most superordinate institution of domination in a capitalist society is that these societies are organized around a pervasive system of domination built into the economic structure. That's a problem that the state faces, is that it's the most superordinate institution of domination in a society that contains a very powerful and systemic system of class domination. And how those two systems of domination fit together is a crucial problem. The solution to that problem is indeed that the state develops a class character. So I will affirm in our discussion on Thursday that the state does have a class character. It is a capitalist state. It has a deeply embedded class character. But that's not definitional. It's not what renders it a state. It's what renders it a stable state in the context of an economy that has a dominant capitalist mode of production. It's a discovery rather than a definition of the properties of the state that in such a complex configuration of state and economy, in order to be stable, the state has to assume a variety of particular attributes, which then we can describe as having a class character. As a general methodological point, you know, and this is debatable, this is one of these philosophical issues that I don't think there's any unambiguous answer. I prefer to not pack too much into definitions and to allow more space for discovery, given your definitions, rather than to have too many of your theoretical conclusions then brought back and packed into the very definitions of concepts. Right, so that's why in this case I prefer not to define the state as a class apparatus of class domination, but rather to treat that something as something that you have to show, and which may be variably true as a result. It may be that in some context the non-class aspects of the state may become quite important. It's not the case, once it's not part of the definition, then you open up a possibility of observing fractures and contradictions and incompletenesses and other principles operating inside of states besides their class character. Now I say that actually while also affirming the very strong class character of the state, which we'll see next time. So this is more a way of how you approach coming to that conclusion. I've already mentioned this. When you define the state this way, it actually opens up an interesting possibility of talking about the degree of stateness of particular states. Now, this isn't a very common way that people talk about these things, and I haven't actually developed this in my own work in any particular way. But I do think it's a sort of interesting idea. It helps to make sense of the Marxian intuition that in a really democratically emancipated, egalitarian society, there's some sense or other in which states look less like states. And the strong rhetoric of that was the withering away of the state. The state actually disappears. Well, I don't think that's a reasonable either prediction or characterization. But there's something in that idea, that states become less like states, that their stateness declines if the domination becomes more democratically subordinated. Pierre Birnbaum talked about the historical variability and the degree of stateness of states. It's one of his central ideas.
What's it?
Pierre Birnbaum. Birnbaum. He's a French political sociologist. Democracy, in a sense, is a principle, a social principle for the exercise of political power. It's a principle for the exercise of political power, but in a sense, it's anti-statist, since it implies that the state has less autonomy to determine the character of the relations which it produces and reinforces. So there's a way in which radical democracy has a kind of anti-domination and thus anti-statist character. Last point of this first block of what will be a lecture that'll more than spill over into next class. The contrast between state and civil society. So this raises another one of these big kinds of questions. Any concept, any theoretical object gets its meaning by the contrast space, right? We've talked about that a little bit. Some concepts, you only really get to understand how they work, what they are, when they're contrasted to other concepts. So that's how we sort of worked on the concept of race, was by contrasting race as a form of social division with other forms of social division. It helps to give clarity to what makes a racial division a racial division. The same thing is true for concepts like the state. And here a common contrast is between the state and civil society. The concept of civil society is particularly vague in lots of discussions. It was a very popular term that got a lot of currency in the 1990s. It's begun, I think, to wane. You know, there are these fads in social theory. Civil society is no longer quite such a popular expression. Generally, it's used to refer to those aspects of social life that could be termed as having strictly external relations to the state. They exist autonomously from the state, have their own mechanisms of reproduction, but in various ways interact with state apparatuses. primary examples of social relations that are in civil society would be social networks of various sorts, voluntary associations, what are loosely called communities, families. Families are often the kind of paradigmatic entity that's in civil society. Critics of the state-civil society distinction argue that because the state is implicated in everything, the state regulates production, accumulation, the state regulates the family, you know, the fact that we have laws against marital rape, for example, which was a big change in the last 30 years, that reflects the state's intervention in regulating the private sexual affairs of adults in families, to say that sexual violence within a family is still sexual violence. All of these indicate, some people say, that civil society doesn't exist externally to the state. All aspects of social relations have an internal relationship to the state and therefore shouldn't be separated as a distinct sphere. So that's the critics of the idea of civil society and of distinct spheres, this sphere-like way of talking about society, say that because the state regulates everything one way or another, everything should be incorporated as part of the, as having internal connections with the state. These criticisms, I think, conflate the important fact that all social relations and practices have political aspects with the problem of distinguishing the state as a specific apparatus from other institutional arenas in a territory. So everything has a political aspect. There are political aspects of the family, and the political aspects of the family may be the subject of, or the object of regulation by the state. But nevertheless, state apparatuses are distinct from other machinery, other social institutions and organizations in the society. In terms of the definition of the state that I elaborated above, the state-civil society distinction hinges on the existence of arenas of political practice in which, at a minimum, situational power is not exercised by the state or state officials. It's not state officials that are exercising the situational power within the factory or the situational power within the family. If the state exercises situational domination everywhere, then the state is not simply the most superordinate institution of domination, it's the only organization of domination. That is, if the state isn't, you know, just superordinate above other sites of domination, but it directly, in the situational sense, the actual exercise of power over people is existing in every organization. This is the image embodied in the concept of the totalitarian state. So in that idealized concept of the totalitarian state, civil society disappeared. And that was never actually true, even in the worst days of Stalinism, it wasn't actually true that the state apparatus of the Soviet Union penetrated the pores of every domain of social life and directly dictated what people do on the ground. But it was truer. It was more like that. But so long as this isn't the case, there remain sites of political power, initiatives, struggles, and thus we could say sites of politics that can't be subsumed as simply part of the state. And I think that's why it's still useful to talk about the state and civil society. Yes, Kate, you had your... Okay, well...
well, I guess maybe it's...
Well, you have time for a quick...
So, could you talk about the Gramscian definition of civil society? Is this similar to what you're saying, or does it differ?
Well, I'd have to read... I don't remember exactly... You'd have to give me the specificity of Gramsci's definition of civil society before I could answer it with any precision. But since I broadly am sympathetic to what Gramsci says about lots of things, I would say, as a probabilistic statement about the my answer to the question, it's probably similar. So if you want to bring to the table at the beginning of the class on Thursday, reminding me of what precisely is the Gramscian concept of civil society, then I can answer the question with a little bit less hedging.
Sounds good.
Okay? I want to just ask a quick question of you. So, look, I'm going through this in a relatively belabored way, right? Pretty slowly and detailed, which is squeezing out the conversational side. Is this too... Just tell me, frankly. I mean, I need the feedback in order to make adjustments.
We didn't read it.
What?
We didn't read it.
So you would prefer a more condensed, with more
yes.
space?
Granted, I've also had stuff like this in and out of classes. So
yeah. Just.
Yeah, I like that. Can I read them better or read all of them?
You know what? Here's a suggestion that we might just think about. If there's a subgroup that would like to have a couple of hours of a kind of open discussion around the remaining blocks of the course, so state and politics, we could have a two-hour evening seminar at my house. And for ideology and culture, we could have a two-hour seminar. I'm happy to figure out a time we can discuss it, when we could have kind of a separate time to just have that sort of form, and people could bring questions, and we could do that on an evening.
Would that be in lieu of coming to this, or in addition?
No, not in lieu of. No, the idea would be we're going to continue this, but then we would have just a way of having an extended collective conversation without being in competition with trying to get through the didactic thing. So on think about that on Thursday. We'll see if there's enough interest to set up a time. I guess we'd set up a time for next week for doing that. Okay.
I have a question really quick. There's a lot of readings for Thursday session. If a person, for example, wouldn't have really some time to get all the Thursday and prioritize, even on the prioritization.